Welcome once again to Profiles. I'm Peter Jacoby. And you know, at one point in recalling his pioneering and critical 30 years with the New York City Ballet, Lincoln Kirstein effuses over the work of colleagues George Balanchine and Jerome Robbins on a major production, that of Pulcinella, with Stravinsky's delicious score. Edward Villella had the title role, and his partner was a lovely lady I'm facing in the studio today, Violette Verdi. Violette Verdi, wrote Kirstein, was perfectly tailored as a soubrette of surpassing elegance, with her Gallic savor, precision, waifish regret, and neat musicality. She served as his good fairy, mistress, and partner. Madame Verdi has been a prima ballerina, a company director, a choreographer, a teacher, and she's now a much-admired member of the faculty in the ballet department of IU School of Music. We thought it high time to chat with her about a distinguished career and permit her to share thoughts about dance and dancers, art and artistry. So I want to welcome you, Violette Verdi.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do you recall moments from your active dancing career, such as the Pulcinella, distinctly, or do they just become sort of part of a wash that's the painting of a life?
No, I think that the great experience of having worked with George Balanchine and Jerome Robbins can never be completely forgotten and remains in itself a high point in my life and in my work. And I'm saying life and work because by then it becomes so important that it's your life, literally. And the details that came and the delight of receiving the right solution on that score with the choreography and the role.
Now, you've been labeled a Balanchine ballerina, one of those intuitive dancers for whom the legendary choreographer created ballets. What was such an experience like? What was he like?
He was a great man. He was a real gentleman, first of all. There was very little ego. He had a very good memory, which served for some of the ego he didn't have, to sometimes remember certain things about people and maybe make them understand a little lesson here and there. But he had no ego, really. He was entirely given to the work. He never wanted to be called an artistic director. He said something so beautiful about that. He said, you know, if it was good enough for Jean-Sébastien Bach to be called Kapellmeister, then I want myself to be called Balletmeister. That is plenty good enough. There's no such thing as an artistic director. He always said that. And also, he didn't consider himself a choreographer. He said, you know, there's no such... A poet is not called Mr. Poet. I'm not Mr. Choreographer. I'm an artisan. I know my craft. And that, I think, I do well. And, of course, as you know, he's been compared to Fabergé, to Mozart, in his prolific output, and also in the knowledge and the sum of knowledge that went in the details of the works and his choice of the dancers. That to him, we were like a garden and an orchestra, both, with all the richnesses that both can offer.
Those must have been very special years for you. Special. How long were you working with him?
I stayed with him for 19 years. And the only reason I left, I still had a little dancing left in me, but it was time to begin. With the offer I received from Rolf Liebermann, who was a great friend of Balanchine, and they had worked together in Hamburg many times. And as you know, Liebermann came and literally renewed and saved the Paris Opera, which was not doing well. I couldn't refuse the offer that was made to me to go to take over the directorship of the ballet there. And I was to be the first woman, actually, to do it. And I knew it was a call to the war, really. And I was scared. But it was adorable to hear Mr. Balanchine and Liebermann took me out to the Pierre Hotel, I remember, for lunch. And in front of me, they discussed my fate. And it came out that they thought I needed two lawyers. lawyers, one for myself, for my contract, and one who would know all about the unions in France, because the great problem in France is the unions, since people have become so professional about strikes nowadays, more than about work. So this is what happened to me after those 19 years. I couldn't refuse the offer. They needed a French passport. I still had it. And all the great choreographers were afraid to work there. So they had to look at the aging dancers, and I was one of those. So I became the number one victim, the obvious victim. And I realized I had to do it, and I loved it, and I cried a lot also. It broke my heart many times, but I would forget with some of the great performances because they have an incredible ballet company.
Well, take us back to the Balanchine years first. And can you help us recreate a period when you were developing a ballet with him, what it was like?
It was a little bit like being invited to a very special gourmet dinner. Balanchine would say to me, I have nice piece of music, and I think you would be right person to do this, and we will start rehearsal tomorrow afternoon. So you came super prepared and totally ready for anything he would want. And he would sit at the piano and describe to you a little bit of the score and what the orchestration would be, in case you didn't know already. And he would say, very nice, here we do this. And then he would get up and show you some steps. And he would very quickly decide if you were going to overcome some of the difficulties. And if not, he said, I can do something else. And we'd say, oh, Mr. B, I'm going to work on it. No, no, I can find something else. And he'd give you another step, equally wonderful, even more marvelous. And he would leave me. He said, you are very musical. You run over there, do a little something if it's too long before you start your next step. You will know how to use something, some swell in the music or whatever. And he would also leave you with that freedom of working on it. And after it would be over, you'd say, oh, Mr. B, it's so beautiful. And he'd say, I'm so glad you like it. Yeah, it's not bad. I think Mozart would be pleased. I think, you know, as long as he's happy, I will be fine. So that's what he would do. He would give it to you, and then he would leave you with it, totally finished with it, and just pleased that you were pleased with it. It was a present each time, a wonderful present.
Now, what were some of the roles that he created for you?
Oh, my God, if I can remember all this. Liebeslieder Waltzer, one of the couples. In the Jewels, the section of the Emeralds, which is, of course, Gabriel Fauré, French. And also La Source, which is more Delibes, beautiful composer, Delibes, La Source. And also some funny things he did, electronics with Remy Gassman, the only electronic piece he did, very, very nice. Figure in the Carpet, which was, in fact, my section was water music and some wonderful things in it. And, oh, my God, Glinkayana, a whole composite of many small pieces by Glinka, concert pieces by Glinka. I got a polka in which I was a French maid. It was, you know, and Sonatine, you know, Ravel Sonatine, which is, in fact, the last piece he did for me. Von Himmelhoch, also from one of Stravinsky's composition, was also Bach Stravinsky. But Sonatine was the last exquisite. It was like a cool sherbet that you will have between very wonderful courses of a great long banquet. Beautiful section. Madeleine Malraux came to play it. It was a French festival of Ravel. When it became the centenary and there wasn't one nephew to claim for the rights of the compositions anymore, so we were able to have a great Raveliana at the New York City Ballet.
You mentioned on this list Léo Delibes.
Yes.
Another ballet of his is Sylvia.
Oh, yes.
And I know you brought some music from Sylvia, and I thought maybe we'd take a break in the discussion to hear.
Lovely.
The pas de deux from Act 3 of Delibes' Sylvia. And the performers are the Minneapolis Symphony, and Anatole Fistolari is the conductor. We have heard the pas de deux from Act 3 of Léo Delibes' ballet Sylvia, the Minneapolis Symphony, conducted by Anatole Fistolari, and it's one of the selections that Violette Verdi, our guest in the studio today, brought with her. What makes that music so special in your mind? I think it's gorgeous, of course.
Oh, it is. It is. It marries both what we expect from opera with the legato and the sostenuto of a voice, but it is also the ballet, the ecstasies of violin and dancers. The violin plays a very particular part for us because it gives us, again, that sort of legato that is so hard to sustain. You have to be an expert dancer to be able to, and you can only do it also maybe when you have a partner. But this music is pure ecstasies and peace and harmony, and we love to celebrate those things.
Absolutely. Well, music seems to be a passion for
number
you.
One.
Yeah. And let's go back in your life to the early years, because as I understand it, music was important then, and it is music that led you to the dance.
Literally. Music started taking my life over entirely. You know, in those days, there was no television, but we had good radios and, of course, classical music all the time. And my reaction to music became so extreme that my mother literally took me to a doctor and said, what do we do with this girl? She gets in such states of happiness and despair, depending what the music is. And he said, we have to tie her out harmoniously, make her dance. And that's what we did. And all of that during the Nazi occupation of France. And I started dancing then and there in 1942. And it has been my complete joy and happiness and fulfillment, really. And it has remained my motivation for dancing. I had many injuries. I had many setbacks. But music has always been there to save me and to get me back as long as needed. And now when I teach, one of the things I do, I work a lot with the pianists we have, and sometimes we have new ones, and I love to work with them to develop great repertories and different rhythms and things. I love to marinate in music forever.
Now, what was your early training like?
That was pretty amazing because we had to go to Paris. There was no such
thing.
Let
me ask first where you lived in France.
Yes, of course. Brittany, one tiny little city of 600 people. And the biggest city next to it was Quimper, and very traditional, and I will dare to say a little bit backwards. That particular province, they're rather stubborn, and they want to be independent, as you know. They're one of the provinces in France. And my mother was a school teacher. My father had died, unfortunately, when I was 4 months old, and I was the one and only child. But my mother devoted her life to me from then on, and we went to Paris, and during the time of really famine and no transportations practically, I was able to start ballet with Carlotta Zambelli, who was the last of the great Italian ballerinas of the Paris Opera. Paris Opera always had a great tradition of Italy until the Russians came, of course. But she was still there presiding for the school and the dancers. I started with her. And then we met my teacher, Rosanne Sarkisian, an Armenian woman who had come to ballet rather late, and Viktor Gzovsky, an extraordinary teacher also. And that was, Viktor Gzovsky trained some of the dancers we know, like Vera Zarina, and was a contemporary of Balanchine, a little bit older. So I got that sort of training. And from then on, when I was very, very young, Roland Petit put me on the stage with him.
Tell us about him and your relationship with him in your training years.
A very wonderful person. I mean choreographer, particularly. Trained in France at the Paris Opera, but he freed himself very early because he needed to choreograph. And that was his talent, his great talent. You know, I was thinking just now how wonderful it was for me because I entered a pedigree, a gigantic ballet pedigree that was happening at the same time in France and in the United States. I had my Russian émigrés teachers at the time Balanchine was opening his school with other Russian émigrés in New York. Boris Kochno, who was Diaghilev's secretary, was my first director. And he is the one who really discovered Roland Petit and his talent of choreographer. So Roland was very fertile. He could almost choreograph anything. But in those days, we were still close to the Ballet Russe formula, a libretto, a ballet, a story, and always decors and costumes by famous painter artists, totally in the tradition of Ballet Russe. And little by little, Roland freed himself from all this and also explored the Broadway and the films in Hollywood. By then, I wasn't really working with him that much more, but I learned a lot from him, and none of it I had to dismiss with Balanchine. I used it in a different way. I subdued it in a more abstract way, if you will, but the accent, the inflections, the understanding of the situation would still be there. Somebody said jokingly one day that when I danced the second act of Swan Lake, I insisted to also do the fourth act at the same time, just because the drama had once and for all been understood for me about going on stage and dancing. So Roland was an amazing contributor to my own personal career.
Now, where did your first successes come? At the
with Roland Petit. And very early, my little roommate was Leslie Caron in those days. Mm-hmm. And the two of us were the youngest dancers of the company. And before we were actually big enough to be in the corps de ballet without making a hole in the line, we were given solo parts. And then at some point, we had to do a little bit of corps de ballet, which we learned to do with a good conscience and a good attitude. But we were soloists before we were dancers, really, in a way. So that was
she went on to the movie career.
She went on to the movies. And I also did one with an old director from the UFA, Ludwig Berger. And that it was a wonderful movie with different actors from Germany and France, Gabriel Dorzia and all those wonderful people, and Nicolas Orloff, the dancer. And I did a little bit of acting with Jean-Louis Barrault and Madeleine Renaud, where I met, as I was telling you, Pierre Boulez and Maurice Jarre. In those days, they were writing music for the plays because they were not discovered yet. And they were very poor, I remember, but very talented. So my life was with ballet, though. For me, that was the choice.
When did you come to this country,
then? With Roland Petit the first time in 1953, and with an English company in 1954, 1955, and eventually with American Ballet Theatre, where I was for 1 year, and I had some wonderful ballets to dance from their classical repertory, and also Mademoiselle Julie, Miss Julie, which was done at the time by Birgit Kohlberg. Mm-hmm. And I had the great luck to dance with some great male dancers like Eric Brune, John Kreitza, Royce Fernandez, all the great dancers. And Nora Kay was dancing, and sometimes Alicia Alonso and Yuskevich would come too. So that 1 year in Ballet Theatre was marvelous. And I would have stayed probably, but the company had to close to recover financially and get reorganized. And Mr. Balanchine called me because he had come to see some performances. And I couldn't believe that he would call me because earlier you were saying Balanchine ballerina, but I didn't think I was the type. People in those days thought that he only loved the great greyhounds, the tall, beautiful greyhounds of America with long shin bones and the small heads. And I was that French petite proportion, but really small thing. And he told me one day, he said, it's not the size, it's the content with you.
But you were an unusual choice because he liked to take the young, budding artist.
I know.
You had had, what, 10 years or so?
Some experience already. But what also he liked my logic. And he said, you're so French, you always have to explain what you dance. And he said, but in the same time, you're very musical. And that was, I think, where we, you know, functioned. And then I realized that he even had smaller than me after that. Suki Shorer was even a little bit smaller. And then nobody was jealous of anybody because he was very generous. He was a good father, a good patriarch. He cut the wedding cake into many pieces for the tall, medium, and small dancers. We got our turns.
You've become sort of a curator for Balanchine Ballet, someone who can bring authority and of having worked with the master.
Yes, in a way. But in my case, you know, all of us inherited and composed a different brand out of and blend out of what we understood about him from our own personal experience, obviously, and limitations, I'm afraid, in my case, I'm sure. And also from each one of us, as I said to Peter Martens, none of us can say, I know all about Balanchine, but we can make a very beautiful big quilt out of it, all of us together. And we do that.
I wanted to share a quote of your own. There's a book called Balanchine's Ballerinas, and one of the chapters is Violette Verdi. And you say, I'll tell you, no matter how divine it is to dance Balanchine's ballets, even after they've been done by 26 other people, nothing can compare with working with him and seeing him create something in front of you, for you.
Yes.
Seeing how he solves the problems that come up with the music and how simple and right his solutions are, it happens with no one else in that way.
No. It's so true. And also, you said one of the words, simplicity. You know, only the very great can reach that simplicity. You know, so many other people do so much stuff just to win their place or to win our attention or whatever. With him, you had to be caught by the awe that you saw of what you realized was happening in front of you and the disarming candor with which it was explained and given to you. It was disarming. And so you were totally penetrated by that and taken over. And again, no ego, you know, beyond. You went beyond.
I want to take up on that simplicity idea in a few minutes, but there's also a composer who created out of simplicity, and that's Mozart, one of your favorites. And you brought some music from his Masonic Mass.
Oh, yes.
The funeral music.
Yes.
And so let's spend a little time with that. Herbert von Karajan conducts the Vienna Philharmonic. We have just heard the Masonic funeral music in C minor, Crescendo 477 of Mozart. Herbert von Karajan conducted the Vienna Philharmonic, and this is one of the selections brought by Violette Verdi, our guest in the studio today. And there is a simplicity, isn't there, to Mozart's music?
Absolutely.
Reaches into profundity, but
totally. And nothing superficial, really. But depth, so much depth that you have to know when not to add. And Balanchine knew that. There were many works he never wanted to choreograph, from his great friend Stravinsky particularly, of course. Like Rite of Spring, he said, why superimpose yourself on what is already a complete, marvelous work? And he wouldn't do it. And jokingly, he would say, because he admired Robin's talent very much, so he could allow himself to say little things like that. Oh, Jerry could do it, though. Because Jerry didn't know that much better than Balanchine. Balanchine knew just a little bit more in that sense.
Now, what impact did all this dancing with Balanchine and your whole dancing career have upon your years as director and years as choreographer?
Profound impact. Clarification of values and also respect for them. Again, not using them gratuitously for effect or for anything like this. That goes for people, that goes for work, that goes for everything. Respect of the values at hand. And also making choices between how you want to function, what you want to bring, if it is going to be educative or profane, if it is supposed to cater to a lower thing to supposedly have more success, or if it is aiming high in spite of maybe no returns in order to establish and celebrate a conviction of that kind. That I learned from him, too. There was already some of that in my education, because if I look back in a very strange, wonderful way, everything seems to have been in logical order of development, but always with the same values. So and it's not always easy to stick to them. It is an effort, and you have to think about it every day.
I imagine it did become a problem when you had to run a company.
Oh, yes.
Now, you traveled back across the Atlantic.
Yes, I did. And after that, I went to Boston because I worshipped E. Virginia Williams, one of the many women founders of ballet, because ballet was founded in this country, of course, by patient, stubborn women who would take hardship and refusals of all kind and go right back and do it again. It had to be women to do that. Now it's in the hands of men because it has succeeded, and it's expensive. So the men have to take care of that achievement now. But Virginia, I went to work for her, which was the opposite of the Paris Opera, which is entirely government subsidized, and the Boston Ballet, where you had to beg more or less elegantly all the time. But I realized during those times, with my best effort, that I did not have the qualities required already in our day and time to be a director, which is why I didn't want to be the chairman of the ballet department here either. Our excellent Virginia Sesbron is doing that because she's much better than me with arbitrary decisions and money problems and those things, you know, problems of all kind. It's not for me. I am good in a studio with the dancers. I have a hard time making decisions. It's very hard for me, very painful. And I seem to lose my edge for my work if I do that. So I knew to take myself off that part, which is not the right casting for me.
So how long were you in Paris?
I was there for 3 years, but that is because Lieberman was leaving. And usually they gave a contract for a year, but he insisted that I would get 3 years. And then the next director, who was a singer, Bernard Lefort, and whom I knew, came to talk to me and said I would be there, but I didn't count on it, and I was right. And by then, I thought it was all for the better. But I went to Boston, and it finally dawned on me that that wasn't my best role. And I don't feel bad. I'm relieved when I know what I can do, frankly. And I can do other things.
Well, as one studies your career, and I noted this watching the fascinating documentary that ran recently on WTIU, you've had a special devotion for teaching.
Oh, yes.
An activity that busies you now here at IU School of Music. What is it about teaching? What is it being able to mold a young person?
Yes, but mold them is, before that comes, which sometimes has to be done in a way, it's just seeing their appetite, their desire, and giving something for that, and teaching them what they want to learn and know, to reveal themselves, to accomplish themselves, and to be happy with what they're doing, to free themselves in their knowledge. That, to me, is the most amazing phenomena, and I never get tired of it. And it keeps me young, in a way. I'm not young anymore, but I'm still young enough that I can maybe go through a little bit longer, because it is the most extraordinary extraordinary, rewarding pleasure to see what they can do. We have an amazing ballet department as it is, because dancers who come to us are already trained, and the teachers are better everywhere in the regions. And so we get better dancers all the time. And Jacques Cesbron, who choreographs for each dancers all the time when they come, is saying it. It is such a reward at this point. Virginia said the same things. All our guest teachers are in so surprise and in great admiration of what we have now, because the dancers are excellent, and with their amazing discipline of doing their academic studies and that, they are so available and rigorous and lovely people. Lovely.
I haven't had the privilege of watching you in a teaching situation, but seeing you in action on the film suggests that you're both demanding and nurturing.
Yes, that's right. That's what happens.
Both sensitive and authoritative.
Exactly.
How would you describe your classes?
Well, sometimes there's too much of an abundance of words, of course, as you see by now. I could drown many fish in all those words, but I learn them. I identify with them, and I find the buttons. I love to find where I can push, where I can press, where I need to help. I love to play with them, only to know them, to absorb them, and to respond to who they are. I have to absorb them first so that I know what I'm dealing with. And that is part of the delight of the operation. And so I'll go from pushing and being tough. I can be all of that. I don't particularly have to do it too often, I'm glad to say, to very encouraging, funny, anything that can help them. They always tell me, you say, you're so funny. And I said, good.
How about choreographing for the unfinished dancer? You mentioned
I love that.
Jacques Cesbron does a lot of it, but you do some.
I try to do a little bit. You know, I'm the oldest member, of course, over there. And so it's not so easy for me. But when Jacques was on sabbatical, I realized that I would have a little more time also to work with the dancers. And, you know, we're running out of space. And all of us are like, every day we're trying to negotiate who gets what, the big studio, the medium, the small, and sometimes we end up a little bit in the lobby too. You know, I mean, like, oh, everybody is running out of space in the School of Music. So last year, I was able to do a bigger piece, the Hummel Concerto, yes, which was one of my favorites, and I'd been waiting to do it at some point. So I love to choreograph, but, you know, I consider myself, I wish there was a different name, some sort of ballet master choreography or educator choreography, something like that. I think I'm a bridge between the great choreographers and the teacher that I really am all the time.
Now, as we talk, you're helping to put the finishing touches to a fall program of dance by the IU Ballet Theater. What is it like to engage in this kind of an endeavor?
Well, it's usually quite a bit of a rush. We never have enough time or space, nor space. And even when we get on stage for that 1 week before the performance, we are very tight with the space that we get in order to rehearse everything from a technical point of view, lighting, and costumes, the musicians, the dancers. It's a big deal. But we start in the studio and we work as hard as we can every day with the space we have. And we managed to put, even for the fall, which is more of a chamber performance, we managed to put on quite a bit of a program, really. And we try to use also as many of our beautiful dancers as we can, because they get very mournful when they're not used, you know. So anyway, we have a very interesting program. Jacques Cesbron is doing a Liszt sonata, which is absolutely superb. Johnny Clifford, The Rite of Spring for four hands. Emil Naumov, and I think a student also is going to play with him. And I think Corey Smith is playing for Jacques Cesbron, by the way, for the list. Virginia Cesbron has a quartet. She has a Tchaikovsky piece that she revived that she had done before. And I'm staging the Tchaikovsky Pas de Deux by George Balanchine, with, unfortunately, I'm afraid, a tape, because it was very difficult to find enough pianists ready available to do it. But, you know, it's Tchaikovsky, so it's kind of nice to hear one composition with music. And also, it's an interesting thing. It was discovered in a museum in Russia after the Bolsheviks had supposedly destroyed everything. And that little piece survived. It was a Black Swan project by Tchaikovsky for Swan Lake. And it was never used because nobody knew about it. But since it was discovered, Balanchine used it and did that pas de deux. And I happened to be the one that ended up dancing it with my partner, Conrad Ludlow, and then with everybody else under the sun. And the whole world dances that piece. It's a very hard piece for young dancers. But like with Balanchine, highly educative and strengthening. So they will look wonderful in it.
Now, you've put this all together in just a matter of weeks.
Oh, very few
weeks.
Because
you start with the beginning
in September. Yes, Labor Day we started. Uh-huh. Yes, so it's been really, because, you know, we're very faithful to the classwork we do. We do it very seriously. We have that huge 1.5-hour class, 3 classes running at the same time because we have now 70 dancers and 15 boys. And then we have point classes for the ladies, at least 2 of them running at the same time, and also a men's class, and sometimes adagio class also for partnering. And then we go into rehearsals usually at 2:30. Sometimes when we get closer to performance, we sacrifice a little bit of the length of some of the classes in order to rehearse more. But we try to, technically, we do our studying work very seriously every day. You know, dancers have to take class every day till the end.
You sound very happy with this phase of your life.
Oh, totally happy. I love the department. I love my colleagues, the dancers. We have good pianists also and wonderful musicians that come by to work with us. Our guest teachers, wonderful people that come, choreographers of all kinds. It's just wonderful. It's both being a school and the luxury of a ballet company as well. So who could ask for anything more? It's the same image with Bloomington. It's such a not completely well-kept secret. I think it's well-known now. But, you know, it's also all this is very serious, and yet you have everything here.
Where's ballet going? Do you see a future? I mean, you see the future dancers.
Oh, yes.
Will they have a profession to go into?
Yes, I think they will. The only problem with ballet is that at the very beginning, Lingard Kirstein said it's really a highly suspicious activity. I don't think he would say that anymore after the success of the New York City Ballet and all companies. No, I think choreographers need to be developed, nurtured, because one of the great things about Mr. Balanchine, of course, was his background. And Jerry Robbins, the same thing. They had such a background of craft, knowledge, and experience with different types of dancers, companies, and countries, and with the national, you know, idiosyncrasies everywhere being different. That is still the rare bird, but they're developing too. Dancers, strangely enough, want to do it because the discipline of ballet is something that you can only get otherwise in high scientific pursuits or maybe in a military school, which is not so appetizing sometimes. But the discipline of the artist, which is not defined in the more popular realm, is very defined in ballet, very strengthening, and they love to learn it and go beyond. They learn to be free going through it, which is, of course, the magic of one of those forms of arts. You go through the discipline entirely so you can be free. No freedom instead.
I just wanted to have time maybe for one more question. Teaching. I want to go back to teaching because that seems to be the culminating
yes.
force in your life.
Yes.
What have you been able to do here at IU with students that has added a dimension to your life and your career?
Well, I have been able to teach on a regular basis and without traveling as much as I used to do when I was teaching at the beginning, which means that I have the luxury to see them grow, develop. I'm not the only teacher. All of us contribute, of course, to this. But I have the luxury to see them grow and become, especially in their third and fourth year. And I have the satisfaction to see them get totally professional jobs in the Boston Ballet, the Washington Ballet, San Francisco Ballet, Pittsburgh, Charleston, Richmond. I mean, very good ballet companies in this country, in par with people that come out of ballet schools who have never gone to a university. But seeing them becoming more mature because they are at the university, because we get those 4 extra years with them of at the time when they are still fragile, fearful of their future, in competition with people that are not so well-educated and so disciplined, and in the hands of a big company where there's too many dancers that you can take care of them personally. So this is what we achieve here. And morally, I have a huge moral satisfaction for the treatment we give them, in the sense that we are true to them, their age, their development. Adolescence is a hard, hard age. And even for a ballet dancer, same thing, you know, plus being a ballet dancer. So we have that here in a guarded situation with very loving people who take care of that. So, and also I've been able to do a little bit of choreography, and I worship every performance I can catch here in Bloomington from the great musicians, the great artists, some of the theater. I wish I could go to more, but dancers are very tired at night, and sometimes we have to go home. But I do what I can to catch some of the richnesses and beauties of Bloomington, the jewels of Bloomington.
Well, a lot of interviewers like to end their interviews by asking, is there something that you haven't done that you would still like to do? But I think you've already
more of the same
answered, yes.
More of the same until it's time to go.
Well, it's gone so fast, this hour at least, so I want to thank you.
Oh, Violette, I thank Verity. You for asking me. Thank you.
Violette Verity, thank you for spending this hour with us. You've given us a feel, I think, a real feel for the world of dance to which you've contributed so very much. And it's been a great pleasure for me. My name is Peter Jacoby, and I thank you all for listening. We're going to end our time together with some Schubert, because you brought in something you love a great deal, and that's the string quintet in C. The second movement, the Adagio, we won't be able to hear all of it, but let us sort of hear the concluding portion of it. It is with the Emerson Quartet and with cellist Mstislav Rostropovich.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in September of 2003, Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash, Luann Johnson, research assistant. Information about this and other programs can be obtained at 812-855-1357. Profiles programs can also be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.